Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today I have a great guest on. His name is Peter. He has written a book, and it's kind of a really neat book. I've read it a couple times. It goes into pretty much in depth, but I'm going to bring Peter on right away so we can talk a little bit about who he is, and then we'll go into the book. So, Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Nancy. Nice to be back again.
Good. Now, Peter, can you tell the listeners a little bit about who Peter is and how you came about writing a book called Pope Annalisa?
Sure. Well, the idea that I had for the book came about a little over a decade ago. I was in a screenwriting class in New England, and the instructor came in and asked us to think of an idea that nobody had ever done before, a very original idea. And being spiritually oriented, I guess my mind started to track in a certain direction, and I said, well, you know, we've never really seen anything like a female priest or certainly not a female pope in the Catholic Church before. And I kind of proceeded from there to envision what would a world be like and what would this woman be like to be able to break into an institution that's been exclusively male for 2,000 years, and it just sort of kind of took off from there.
Which is, it is kind of different, and it's very intriguing because people have to sit back and kind of wonder what would happen if all of a sudden we had a female pope, and not just a female pope, but one who's also, you know, a black African pope. I mean, I would think it would probably rock the world pretty bad, don't you?
Well, I think so, but I think depending upon the person, and certainly in the book, Pope Annalisa is a very unique person with spiritual gifts, that it could be something that would be a real light into the world, because we've really kind of had it one way for so long, for 2,000 years, isn't it? And to go in another direction with a different perspective that would bring would really be something.
It would be, I think it would actually be very different and very unique, and I think it's worth maybe trying it sometime to see how it would really go, because what we have done, at least in my opinion, has really changed the idea of who we are and how we're supposed to believe, or what we're supposed to believe, according to what we have been told forever. And sometimes what we are told forever isn't necessarily truth. So maybe this might bring about some kind of truth. So when you sat down to write this book, what was your very first instinct on writing it?
Well, actually, I wrote the book backwards, and I envisioned the final scenes of the book. And I kind of proceeded really to write the book essentially in a backwards manner. And I really wanted to start to explore the nature of the main character, who is Annalisa. But I also wanted to introduce other characters who were very closely entwined with Annalisa, because collectively the characters in the book represent different archetypes or patterns of humanity. In fact, the book is part of a trilogy called The First Souls, and The First Souls really are just that. They're metaphors or symbols for the origin, the direction, and the evolution of humanity. They sort of typify all of us. And I started really the book as a character exploration, but, you know, the book has a lot of profound spiritual content to it, and very soon thereafter, I really had to concentrate on the plot line, because the one thing that you really want to do is you don't want to be like a preacher in a soapbox in a park corner somewhere preaching at your audience. That's the surest way to kill a fictional work. And in order for the spiritual message to get through, I really wanted to make it a page-turning thriller that people could read just as well for the content of the story as for the content of the spiritual message. And from the reviews that have come in and the awards that the book has won, it seems that the book was able to walk that balance between those two aspects successfully.
Yeah, again, you know, I read it, and it's very intriguing, actually, and I found it very interesting. And so because of that, you know, I think it's important that other people take a look at the book. So why don't we start by telling the people your website and how they can get your book?
Yes, the name of the website is PopeAnnalisa.com. It's PopeAnnalisa.com. I've actually just recently reconstructed the website. It's a pretty cool-looking website now. It has a lot of information about the thematic background of the books and different topics about lost ancient spirituality that we're recovering, as well as videos and audio interviews. So it's a very complete website. And the book itself can be purchased really through any major bookstore in the country. If they don't have it on the bookshelves, they certainly can order it through their databases. And you can also order it online through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Give out the website again, Peter.
Yes, it's PopeAnnalisa.com, PopeAnnalisa, one word, PopeAnnalisa.com.
Okay. And so if you're listening right now, you can actually go there and kind of check it all out. So, you know, you said you wrote it backwards,
mm-hmm.
and because you wanted to mostly get into, like, the main characters. Other than Pope Annalisa, who are some of the other main characters?
The other characters in the book are really four other characters, and their lives are intertwined very closely with Annalisa's, but they're not always necessarily believers or even followers of Annalisa, because the book is a complex book and Annalisa is a complex character. Throughout much of the book, we don't really know what Annalisa's agenda is. We don't know whether she comes into a world which is very troubled. Iran has gone nuclear. Iran and America are just about to square off into a nuclear confrontation. The Catholic Church is being torn apart after she becomes Pope. Demonic symbols start appearing around the Vatican, and nobody knows who's placing them there or what they mean. And it's a rather dark world where America is almost in a permanent recession. This is the year 2025, I should say, in the near future. And global resources of oil and even water are running scarce, and the great nations are competing with one another over dwindling resources. So it's really kind of a powder keg. And Annalisa comes into this world, and matters seem to get very worse once she becomes Pope. So many people are out there wondering whether Annalisa is really a savior of the world, or whether she's the force that's sort of creating all the problems in the world. And there was a body of prophecy that predicted the rise of a miraculous figure who would sort of lead the masses astray and cause the ruin of the church and lead the world order into fire. And many people are saying, well, we believe that she is the figure that's mentioned in the prophecies. So the other figures around Annalisa, for much of the book, are very instrumental in trying to figure out what is her secret, what is she all about. And what they learn is quite shocking, because not only do they learn about her, but they learn about their connection to her and about their fate in essentially a cosmic drama that's been played out for thousands and thousands of years.
There's been a lot of lost information, actually. Your book does bring out a lot of that, and I think we are starting to rediscover now about all the feminine energy that is really going to be coming to this earth very quickly. And I take that as a very good sign, because masculine energy has been very hard and very cold, and that's what creates a lot of the war. But feminine energy is made out of love. And, you know, reading your book, it was really funny, because you go from almost one end of the scale to the other with what people can believe, because people have, again, their own little minds, you know, to either believe something or not believe something. But even before you wrote this book, you also had a lot of experiences of your own. Is that not true?
That's correct.
Okay. So let's go backwards a little bit and talk a little bit about that, and then we're going to go back into the book and kind of relate that to what, you know, you've already gone through. How's that?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I, as a young man in my teens, I felt kind of a sense of alienation with the world, and that's not uncommon for teenagers, but I felt that either something was wrong with me or something was wrong with the world, because it just didn't seem like things should be the way they were. It seemed like, why wasn't the earth and society, you know, a better place to live? And I guess you could say that I was a seeker from an early age, trying to understand more about those questions, just to figure out my own place. And I happened to notice in the newspaper one day, and this was back in the 70s, that they were teaching courses to sort of enhance your psychic perceptions, or your ESP, they called it back then. And to make a long story short, I went through a week's course, and I found out at the end of that I had a real proficiency in doing intuitive medical readings and remote viewing and several other types of, I guess, what you could call psychic phenomena. But I think the thing that probably struck me most was that in the exercise of these abilities, especially being able to read so accurately, you know, the physical and mental state of another human being who was tens of thousands of miles away, and all I was given was their name, age, and address to get that kind of accurate information, that I had to be tapping into a source that connects us all together, and that if I was allowed to tap into their energy, that we must be connected by this energy field. And then I started meditating on that, and I just started getting all kinds of information coming in. It was almost like most of my life I've been trying to tune a radio station in, and all I was getting was static, but finally I hit a clear channel, and it was broadcasting 24/7, and it was giving incredible information out. And that was probably a turning point in my life, because we've all been raised in our traditional religions to, you know, understand that there is an unseen world or there is a spiritual world, but it's more like an intellectual proposition, and it's something that we take on faith because most of us have never experienced that. But when I experienced that through the story that I just told you, I graduated from faith or belief that these things exist to knowledge that they exist. And knowledge is something that you can always take with you. You kind of own that because you've been through it. You've actually touched it, felt it, derived information from it, applied that information in the practical world. And that's a very life-changing experience because, again, knowing something to be real and just assuming something to be real based on the word of others is two different things.
Well, it is. And unfortunately, a lot of people try to base it on the word of others, and that doesn't usually work. When you were writing the book, Peter, did you get any kind of, let's say, channeled messages?
A lot. It was a very emotional period of time during much of the writing of the book because my wife was battling cancer for about 10 years, and I stopped work for a year or so to take care of her, and especially during that time, a lot of information was coming through. In fact, so much so that I actually fried half a dozen laptop computers in the space of about 3 weeks. People wouldn't let me get near their electrical equipment after a while. They were a little, you know, nervous about me being around their stuff. And I, to give you an example of some of the information that came through, the book started off in the context of a war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, with America leading a coalition of forces over there, and then we entered the first Gulf War. So I changed that storyline around because I didn't want it to be dated, and I updated it to a second Gulf War with Saddam Hussein's sons sort of taking a prominent role in that geopolitical battle, and then we had the second Gulf War with Saddam and his sons at center stage. So I said, okay, well, I don't want the book to be dated, so I changed that again. And I said, let's move over to Iran right now with Iran acquiring nuclear weapons. And I think we all know what the headlines have showed about this. But by that time, I said, no more changes. It's going to press as is, and this is the last time I'm going to change it around. So I was getting quite a bit of information on all fronts, on geopolitical events and many other aspects about the book, some of the spiritual aspects of the book too, but those are just a few examples of some of the information that was coming through at that time.
For the people, Peter, that you think will read your book, do you think it's going to change their mind about religion, or do you think they're going to look at it that this is a attack on religion? How do you think they might interpret it?
Well, it's really a book about spirit transcending religion. And it's very respectful of religion because, unlike many books or many authors out there who have a very bitter view towards religion as having caused a lot of evils in the world, I don't really see it that way. Not that religion hasn't caused its share of problems in the world. Certainly the type of religion that says, my God is the one true God and yours isn't, is going to set you up for a series of problems. And we've had that problem in Christianity. We've had that problem in Judaism. And now you see it in Islamic fundamentalism. But this is really about a spiritual tradition, a genuine spiritual tradition, which is existent in the threads and the core of the three Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also in just about every other religion that ever existed on earth. It's a universal spiritual wisdom that we're just recovering now in some of the lost Western texts that they found in the Egyptian deserts and in the Judean deserts in the 1940s. And the book sort of proceeds from the premise that religion is sort of an introductory understanding to spirituality. In fact, the ancient Gnostics, what they said about their opponents, the Orthodox Christians, the ones who read the Bible literally and eventually exterminated the Gnostics. The Gnostic view on them was that they are the stepping stone to to spirituality, that you might call it, let's say, religion 101 or spirituality 101, and that you take the things, the concepts, the theologies, the things that you may have learned to give you some idea of what spirit's about from religion, but don't stop there, as religion would like you to do. They'd like you to sort of punch their ticket in their station and stay there. But you're on a journey, you're on a road, and so instead of staying at that one bus stop, move on to the next one and keep learning. And so they took that view of religion, and that's the view that the book has. It doesn't trash religion. Annalisa doesn't trash the Catholic Church. She essentially gets in there and works from the inside out. And for that reason, many people who have read it, otherwise, I won't say many, but the ones who I know of who are evangelical or fundamentalist Christians who have read it, have not been offended by the book, and that surprises some people. They actually really like the book because it respects their outlook. I respect anybody that has a spiritual or religious impulse. That's their way of seeking God. We should never trash that. However, that's not to say that some viewpoints that may be limiting their growth. And so what I'm trying to point out in the book is there's a way to sort of step up higher in the mountain and get a more panoramic view of spirit, and we can move from the station down at the foot of the mountain that we're at right now. We can sort of move upwards, and that's really what the book is trying to present, is a way to take a look at that bigger vision.
Okay, so your book actually kind of tells the difference between spirituality and religion.
Well, it does, because it gets into a little bit of what we spoke about before, the difference between faith and knowledge. My belief is that prophets speak the heart of God, their followers start religions, and the reason for that is that the followers have not had the direct experience that the prophets have had, the visions that the prophets have had, and so they must then intellectually interpret what the prophet has said. And of course, when you get into interpretations, then you're subject to everybody's personal agendas and slants and points of view and, you know, little bids for power and so forth. And then you start to build the whole structure of religious hierarchies and all kinds of impediments that come between a seeker and spirit itself. So that's kind of how that usually unfolds.
For your book, you know, and again, it's called Pope Annalisa, and it's in a series of six, I believe you said. And
three, actually, it's a trilogy.
Three.
There's three books.
Okay. And the first one is The First Souls. And the question would be here, of the wholeness in a universe, how are they deciphering that with apparent duality that we got going on? I mean, some people believe we have a duality, and a lot of people don't.
Right. That's because the appearances, for all intents and purposes, everything in this world has the appearance of being dualistic. But the key word here, the operative word, is appearance. The ancient spiritual tradition would tell us that everything is really one, but the one essentially projects its essence into different points of view, into different spiritual beings or different spiritual orientations, which go all the way down on a chain, ultimately to the human being expressed in a material world. And there were many reasons cited for why spirit does this, but a very simple explanation might be that if there is something that is everything, such as we might call God or the higher intelligence, the only way that it can really experience itself is in essence by projecting itself into a different pole or a different point of view that interacts. And, of course, in a way, that's illusion. That's why the Hindus call the world the great illusion, the great Maya, the great illusion, because in reality, everything is really one essence. But that one essence, in effect, projects itself downward into different states of consciousness. So the purest state of consciousness exists at the very core or highest level, the source. As that consciousness projects itself downward, at each level of projection, the awareness of the source, the clarity of the source, gets a little bit less and less. Think of, for instance, if you're making copies of a DVD or a CD, with each successive copy you make, the resolution or clarity is a little bit less than the version that came before. And so it is with spirit. The further it projected itself outward from the source, the more it was ignorant of the source. But that's the only way that you can create the feeling of separate existence, because if you were the same as the source itself, then everything would be the same. There wouldn't be any sense of separate existence. To have a sense of separate existence, there has to be a certain amount of ignorance of the source to create a feeling of identity. Now, that's why we think of ourselves as individuals, but we also have a concept of God, because the spirit or spark of God is within us, and yet our consciousness has been projected down or stepped down from such a level that we also have an ignorance of God, so we also have a feeling of separation along with that feeling of awareness of a God existing. And that's the story that the ancients told about how the world appears dualistic, but in actuality, when you trace it back to its root, it's all of one source, and we're all connected to that source, all from that source.
Yeah, and I think people have a really hard time with that today, Peter, because you've got to think about this. We have a very hard time loving not only ourselves, but others. And I think people really need to go back to inside themselves and start to learn how to love themselves and then transfer that to learn how to love others. So we're very much separated by, you know, not only culture and religion, but just in the way that the teachings have been for a very long time. And in order to get the world back as a whole, which is really what it needs to be, you know, books like this need to come out, and people need to read them with a very open mind, knowing that it's in their power and their ability to make these changes. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's what this book is really all about. This book is a story that shows how that can happen. And although it shows it in a fictional form, it's a form that's achievable in real life. And I do believe that there is a growing consciousness of wholeness that's occurring in this world, and that is the feminine quality that is coming back into a balance. Now, you talked about the masculine and feminine before. Well, while it's true that the statement that the masculine energy, let's say, has caused lots of problems, that's not intrinsic to the masculine energy. That's the masculine energy out of balance. Feminine energy can get out of balance too, and when either of them get out of balance, it's an extreme that you don't want. We want to be balanced human beings, and I think in this go around, we've gone through cycles in human history where the feminine was predominant one time, and then it swung over to the masculine. I think it's coming back in a circle again, or I should say to a spiral, because I believe we do repeat ourselves, but I believe we go upward a little step each time. That it's spiraling around again. For this impulse of creativity, wholeness, feeling from the heart, these feminine qualities are coming back to balance the masculine qualities, not to replace them or to fight against them, because that would just be repeating the old pattern again, but hopefully this time around to create a more balanced human being. And in the ancient Gospels that were recovered, the Gnostic Gospels in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945, in many of these Gospels, Jesus is saying the two must become one. And what he meant by that was that we must balance the masculine and feminine energies within ourselves, because it's not like masculine energy is exclusive to men, feminine is exclusive to women, and the qualities that go along with those are just exclusive to the two sexes. It doesn't work that way. We all have these qualities, both sides, within us. It's a question of bringing those into an operating balance. And once we do that, we really improve ourselves as human beings. And when we become more human beings, you start adding that up by critical mass, and we become a more whole society, a more whole world.
Man, I would totally agree with that. Now, is the book Pope Annalisa another book about the marriages and children of Jesus and Mary Magdalena?
Well, Mary Magdalene plays a prominent role in the trilogy, more so in the second book, The 13th Disciple, but she's also quite evident in Pope Annalisa. But it has a very different slant from what you just said, which is actually comes under the umbrella of the bloodline theory, and this was something that was pretty much played up in the Da Vinci Code. Dan Brown's central premise in the Da Vinci Code was that Mary Magdalene and Jesus did have children. They were married and they had children, and that Mary Magdalene was the Holy Grail, meaning that she was the receptacle of Jesus's children or progeny. But in Pope Annalisa, it has a different view. It does also view Mary Magdalene as the Holy Grail, but of something much more important than children, which is she was the receptacle of the hidden teachings or wisdom or gnosis, knowledge of Jesus, that Jesus taught in private to the disciples, or that he taught to the more spiritually mature Christians of the early church. Now, if anyone's puzzling at that statement, let me just make a quick footnote in history here. if you read the Synoptic Gospels, you'll see many statements in there that Jesus taught one thing to the masses in parables, but unto the disciples he gave the mysteries. And this is stated in almost every gospel, in Matthew, Mark, so forth. And we also have letters from early church fathers saying that there were two teachings, one for the spiritually mature and the other for the masses, so that you start to form a picture. If we really research it, we start to piece together a picture that early Christianity may very well have been something like the modern Masons or Rosicrucians, in that it was a spiritual system that had different degrees of initiation, and you sort of progressed higher into the spiritual mysteries as you went along. And that was very well the way the early church may have been constructed. And Mary Magdalene was pictured in the recovered Gospels as being Jesus' primary disciple, not Peter. In fact, Peter was just the opposite. Peter was pictured as one of the disciples who had a real hard time understanding the message of Jesus because he couldn't break out of the orthodox chains of his Jewish traditions. And Mary Magdalene so clearly understood his message that when he spoke to the other disciples, she almost functioned as a co-teacher in terms of the questions that she asked and clarifying the statements that he would make to the other disciples. Some Gnostic sects even viewed Mary Magdalene as the embodiment of the Holy Spirit, which was the female counterpart to the male Christ, which was embodied in Jesus. So she was accorded an extremely high standing, and by all those reckonings was probably the primary leader of the way, which is what early Christianity was called. And that may surprise some, but that is actually in many of these recovered texts.
Well, you talk about the first souls. Can you explain those a little bit more, like where did they come from? How long have they been here?
Well, the first souls are fictional characters in the book, but they do represent they're metaphorical, or they represent archetypes for the forces that really ultimately led to the creation of the material world and human beings. And in the book, the first souls are just that. They were the first souls to fall from the spiritual realms into material experience. And the trilogy traces their lives over different epochs as they evolve in terms of having gone down to the lowest expression of spirit, the furthest from the source, which is a spirit in a material body, evolving their way back to recognition of their divine origin and the source of the real power within them, to evolve back upward towards a spiritual state of wholeness. So if you view it as a curve, the first souls represented humanity's curve downward into material experience, but they also are at the forefront of the upward curve back to the source's wholeness. And the first soul trilogy traces the various incarnated lives of these beings over different epochs of human history. But again, it's allegorical for all of us. The first souls are you and me and all of us. It's really about our origin, our destiny, and our purpose as human beings.
In your book, you talk about the first souls and lost Genesis. How does that relate to each other?
Well, there was another Genesis story that was told in the recovered Gospels that predated the fall that was told in the Bible of Adam and Eve. You might call Adam and Eve the second fall, but the first fall was really a fall of spirit from a consciousness of wholeness to a consciousness of separation. And there was a mythology based around a figure called the goddess Sophia. Sophia is wisdom in Greek, and the figure of wisdom, although it may be strange to many of the listeners, is a figure that has always been with us throughout most of religious history. She is in the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, in the book of Proverbs, and the apocryphal book of wisdom. And she appeared in many of the pagan mysteries, and let's not take pagan as a negative sense. The pagan mysteries were highly evolved, and much of Christianity owes its origins to the wisdom that was derived from these mystery seers in the Egyptian schools and Greek schools and whatnot. But the figure of wisdom was always there as the divine feminine force or the divine feminine expression of God, and it was said to be the figure of Sophia that led the fall from the material realms into creation. And it's a little bit ironic in a way, because you might say, well, how would wisdom itself, wisdom's supposed to mean, well, you're pretty bright, you're pretty smart, you're pretty perceptive. How does the embodiment of wisdom go from a higher consciousness to a lower state of consciousness? And the answer to that is wisdom seeks experience. And in essence, that's what the Gnostics and other ancient mystics said that this whole movement of spirit was, a desire to seek different forms of experience, to express itself into different forms of experience. So that Sophia saw the chaotic realm outside of heaven and ventured forth into that chaotic realm. And it was Sophia's contact with the elements of chaos that essentially led to the creation of the material world and ultimately to the embodiment of spirit in the form of human beings. And it was the feminine energy of God that led the creation. And that's why in the earliest religions that we can find that we're aware of, there was a very feminine character to most of them. The worship of the Earth Mother, Isis, Magna Mater, there was a very strong feminine component to it over a period of time for reasons that we won't be able to cover in the length of the show. That shifted around, as we said, to a more patriarchal type of mentality that we have today. But there always was a recognition throughout history that it was the feminine creative force that that led to the birth of the material world. And it was embodied in this myth of Sophia, who was also called the Holy Spirit.
So when people go back and they start to read the Bible, do you think if they would read your book and then read the Bible that they would have some questions about the Bible at that point?
I think they would have a lot of questions about the Bible. And I think the Bible is like any other document. It has very profound spiritual wisdom in it, and it also has some limiting points of view in it, because the Bible, after all, was compiled by human beings. And if you take a look at, for instance, the God of the Old Testament, that's sort of what I would call the old conception of God, the sort of stern, you know, emperor father, bearded old man on a throne who dispenses, justice out there according to our sins or according to our good deeds, and that sort of simple view of God. That was an early tribal conception of the Hebrews of God, and I think as applied to the modern world today, it has a lot of limiting factors to it, potentially limiting factors to it. But if you can take a higher reading of the Bible, and if you can understand the symbology in the Bible, I think it starts to make more sense, and I think my book certainly will help people think of the Bible in a different dimension, and therefore not necessarily, cause them to feel like the Bible is not valid, because that's not at all what the book is saying. But I think the book is saying that there is a higher message that can be sifted out of the Bible to our benefit, and hopefully the book will be a tool to help people do that.
A lot of people find the Bible very, very hard to understand. And the way I think is that the Bible was to be interpreted by each person who is reading it from their heart, and come up with their own choices, their own decisions. A lot of people don't believe that. They think the Bible is the thing to follow no matter what, and yet they get very disturbed by what they're seeing in the world today, because it doesn't quite make sense what the Bible says as compared to how we're all supposed to have this wonderful life, and yet look at what's going on in the world today.
Well, that's a fascinating subject, Nancy, that you're getting into, and I might talk about that for a minute. One of the conditions that we have in the world today, we're very polarized, because you have at one point religion. Let's just take the example of Western religion, particularly centered around the Catholic Church, which has really been the formative institution of our European tradition. The Catholic Church certainly ruled the Western world with an iron hand for many years, and it squelched any kind of scientific inquiry or inquiry into the natural world that didn't jibe with Catholic dogma. And over a period of time, you had this rising tide of scientific inquiry that chipped away at that to the point now where you have a wholesale assault of science on a traditional religion. And what has what that has caused is a polarization where you have a lot of secular materialistic science on one side, and it's pushed people into more and more fundamental points of view on the other side, because when people are feeling attacked, they tend to circle the wagons and retreat. In fact, Islamic fundamentalism, in a large measure, is the response of religious people to attacks or perceived attacks about their religious beliefs of the modern world, and they retreat back into a very fundamentalist or extremist point of view. So the one of the reasons why science was able to attack religion so successfully is that despite the fact that Christianity claims to be a religion of spirit, in fact, it has very materialistic characteristics to it that left it open to attack by the scientists. Now, here's some examples. Orthodox Christianity, I think, really misunderstood the symbolic meaning of the Christian story. So instead of seeing the advent of Jesus as a seminal event of higher revelation, they concentrated on a virgin birth. Instead of understanding the meaning behind the profound spiritualism he taught, they concentrated on his miracles. Instead of perceiving the crucifixion as a metaphor for the way human fear and ego crucify the divine spark that's trying to awaken within us, they concentrated on the physical agony of his death as a blood sacrifice for our sins. So I guess the icing on the cake would be the resurrection, where instead of understanding the resurrection as Jesus awakening this dormant divine wisdom within us with his teachings while we're still alive and in body, Christianity interpreted it as a physical resurrection of the bodies from the grave. So despite the fact that it professes to be spiritual, there are many materialist components, literal components, that Christianity has emphasized, and those are very subject, obviously, to attack by material science because you're playing on their football field. Now, the really encouraging thing about this is that the lost spiritual wisdom, spiritual tradition that I'm talking about in the book, really kind of trumps this old religious point of view with a whole body of information that allows us to see religion in a higher perspective, allows us to see the symbolic meaning of religion as the movement of varying forces that have shaped and affected our lives and helps us to understand those. And the neat thing about this is, on the side of science, the old science, the materialist science, which is out there attacking religion, is now in jeopardy itself, because it's being superseded by a higher science, the science of quantum physics, which essentially is saying, look, you know, this traditional science that we've used to attack religion has a fundamental belief, and that traditional science says that the world was created from material particles, that there really wasn't a God, that all life and existence can be explained by the collision of material particles, which eventually built up into more complex organisms, which in turn led to life, which in turn led to human beings. And quantum physics is telling something very different. Quantum physics is saying that when we examine the most fundamental levels of reality at the quantum physical level, we have so many paradoxes that cannot be explained by this materialist interpretation of science that there is only one way to explain existence, and that is if consciousness came first. Consciousness had to precede everything else in order to explain the phenomena that we're seeing under the microscopes and we're detecting with our instruments in quantum physics. Because if we take the materialist interpretation that matter came first before consciousness, we can't solve these tremendous paradoxes. Only by understanding these weird things that occur in quantum physics, if there's a consciousness out there that is essentially the matrix that has formed our world, and that consciousness in turn expresses itself in the forms of individual consciousness, the observer, the famous observer in quantum physics that observes phenomena happening and affects the actual movement of particles, That's the only way to explain it. So quantum physics is now coming full circle around with the ancient spiritual tradition, and it looks like one day my prediction is that the old view of religion and the old view of science will both go out the window together.
Which I really think they need to be honest, because it doesn't correlate with each other. I mean, you read the Bible, and there are certain parts of that are just so unbelievable that you have to sit here and go, okay, well, how did that happen? And then you hear from the other side saying, well, it couldn't really happen like that because it's impossible. You know, like when they talk about Moses taking, you know, a pair of everything into the ark with him so that it could be saved. People have a hard time imagining, you know, two giraffes, two whatever, walking two by two up this ramp into an ark.
Mm-hmm.
But yet that's the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so a lot of the stories in the Bible, because they have been written over and over again by man, I would tend to believe really cannot explain some of the phenomenon that says it's been happening. But yet when you look at quantum physics, you know, which a lot of people do not understand quantum physics because they don't even understand the word, let alone how it really works. But they look at that as like, that can't be either.
Right.
So at some point in time, it all has to come together. I mean, then there's the other half of the population who totally believe that we're from an ET descendant who brought us here and put us all together like the Anunnakis. Okay?
Right. Yeah, that's sort of another physical interpretation, another materialist interpretation. I think that reading of any spiritual text is like peeling back the layers of an onion. You can understand it at different levels. The most simplistic level of it would be a literal reading, that everything happened in a physical sense and a historical sense. There are what I think would be actually higher interpretations, where you can start to understand the spiritual texts as the efforts of non-technological civilizations or cultures to express mysteries in terms that were common to their age, which usually was through mythic stories and so forth, and that the mythic stories contain a great deal of truth, but the truth is coded into the myths, and the myths and the backgrounds have to be understood to be deciphered. And once we do that, we get the symbology of the story, and we find that the symbology of the Western texts and Hindus and Buddhists and everything are astonishingly similar in terms of what they're saying when we pull back and we start to view the various scriptures from that higher level. So the lower, again, taking the analogy of the mountain, if we're looking at the scriptures at the foot of the mountain, they tend to not seem very related, and you know, they don't make sense to a lot of people. But as you move higher up and you understand the more archetypical or symbolic nature of what the meaning of these texts is trying to say, they're very much pointing in the same direction. And that direction is that all is one. As it is above, so it is below. We were indeed created in God's image, but that doesn't mean that we all look like little gods and he looks like a big human in the sky. What that means is that God gave us divine awareness and free will, which is intention. He gave us the power of intention so that we focus our intention on something, that we create a reality out of it. Those are all divine faculties and attributes that lie dormant within us. And when Jesus said the kingdom is within you, and he was always exhorting us to look within, essentially that's what he was really saying. The image of God is within you. The understanding, the way to think in the divine way and receive divine information, those capacities are all within us, but they don't just automatically manifest. Because remember, we came into this world in ignorance. We moved very far from the source to have this experience of touching the material world. And in order to move back, it's a gradual process of growth. So we have to awaken these faculties within us, which takes study, effort, and it takes responsibility, that everybody should take the same responsibility for their spiritual life that they take for their financial life and their economic life.
Which I think is all true. So give out your website again so people can find you, the name of your book, and where they can get it, please.
Yes, the name of the book is Pope Annalisa, which is part of the First Souls Trilogy. The First Souls Trilogy is Pope Annalisa, the 13th Disciple, and the Light of Distant Suns. The book currently for sale under publication is Pope Annalisa, and the website is popeannalisa.com, P-O-P-E-A-N-N-A-L-I-S-A, that's one word, .com. And it can be found, if it's not found on the bookshelves, it can be ordered through any major bookstore in the country or online from Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
So I'm sure everybody will get, you know, get it. It's a very interesting book, I have to tell you, Peter. You know, it does make you stop and think, and it's got a total different view on a lot of the same subjects that people are trying to basically figure out now.
Well, you know, I think the power of the book, Nancy, I had to do a lot of thinking and talk with a lot of people, because you write a book, but it's another thing to understand what the meaning of the book is to people. It's another thing to sort of articulate that. And I think what this book really does is it doesn't just chronicle a rising energy of conscious evolution that we're evolving towards. It actually articulates it. It brings forth from the subconscious of the reader things that they already know, but they hadn't really put together and brought into their conscious mind. And they, a lot of them have a, wow, that's right, you know, type of moment. And I think that's where the power of the book is. It really brings forth from the subconscious into the conscious mind those questions and things that have probably been bubbling up in the back of our heads.
Do you think, Peter, that in young children, that if they were taught a little bit differently about religion and their emotions and what comes from within, that would make a big difference as the world continues to progress?
A huge, huge difference. Because, remember, we can be born into this world with greater inclination towards spiritual perception or towards higher intelligence, but the environment that we're brought up in still plays a tremendous role in how we turn out with human beings and how our lives turn out. And that gets into parenting, that gets into education, and of course a great part of that education is a religion or spiritual orientation. If all of our youth were brought up with no spiritual inclination whatsoever and said that the only purpose in life is to go out and earn as much money as you can, the world would be in a very sorry state, because that extreme materialism ultimately leads to a dead end. It may temporarily satisfy some of our physical needs, but ultimately it really leads to a dead end. I don't think that the spiritual quest will ever die in a human being, because I think we all have questions about where we came from, what we should be doing, and where we're ultimately going. And I think to the extent that children were given alternative visions to traditional religion so that they can make up their own minds and their choice, rather than be tracked on to something that for years and years they're told to believe is the ultimate truth, and that kind of stops their inquiry, I don't think that's a healthy situation. And that's why I believe that any church or any religion would be well served to act more like a signpost rather than a bus stop, in the analogy that we gave before. A signpost will keep directing you on up the road and help you out and be a facilitator. A bus stop is where they want you to, again, punch your ticket and stay within the confines of those four walls, adopt their belief, and, you know, get a sense of membership in their particular point of view. But that's not what life should really be about. If we want to take personal responsibility and really have freedom as human beings, we have to exercise our choice to grow and to seek and to keep going down that path. And if we can afford that kind of a world or religious or spiritual education to children, I think it would accomplish wonders for our world.
I totally agree with that one. As far as the way religion tries to control people, is there a way for people to have their belief but not have it used as a control factor?
Well, I think the way that you don't let religion or any type of ideology control you, again, is by taking an active role and seeking answers to the questions that you have. Now, the thing about religion is, the reason why organized religion is able to succeed is because, for the most part, people don't take responsibility for their own spirituality. It's easier to go to church, go to confession, have the priest absolve you, and go home and feel like you've done something. Whereas if you want to be a seeker and understand the deeper mysteries of life, it takes some reading, it takes some inquiry, it takes some meditation. We have to put some work and effort into it. And a lot of people feel like, well, gee, I'm just too busy surviving in order to do that. But ultimately, the real survival game comes when we improve ourselves as human beings. If we stay in the same rut and all we're doing is earning a buck to put some food on the table, well, yeah, that's important. But ultimately, we're not going to grow, and when you don't grow, you die. If you don't grow as a society, you repeat your mistakes, and eventually your society will kill itself off from its mistakes. That which you bring forth will save you. That which you don't bring forth will destroy you. So we have to bring forth a higher understanding from the core of each of our beings with a little work and effort. And when you get on that path of inquiry, you almost develop an automatic immunity, in a sense, from the control of any religion, because you can say, you know what, I'll listen to what they have to say, and I might believe in some of it, and I might not believe in other parts of it, but, you know, I'm going to kind of keep moving on down the trail there, and I'm going to keep learning. And it's a great, you know, learning is a great process. I personally love education. This writing this book was a great experience for me in terms of my own spiritual growth as well as intellectual growth, because I had to do research as well as I had to meditate on issues. So it's a rewarding experience for those people that, you know, want to take up the gauntlet and run with it.
You've talked about meditation a couple times, Peter. How important is meditation for people in general? What does it help to accomplish?
Well, I think it's vitally important because there are really two dimensions, two basic dimensions to life. We have the outer or waking consciousness where we're engaged in the activities of survival and doing our day-to-day things, but there's an inner dimension to life. And to hear that inner guidance that I spoke about, that analogy I gave about the radio station, and most of my life I was just getting static, and then one day, because, you know, I went to some effort to do some studying and make some inquiry about it, I was able to actually hit that radio station that was transmitting this incredible information. That really came through meditation. It came through desire, it came through work, but it also came through meditation. And you can't do any one thing. It's got to be an effort on all fronts. You have to engage heart, which is desire. You have to engage mind, which is intellect and curiosity. And you have to use them together and explore all the dimensions so that the dimension of being quiet and still and receiving the information from the greater consciousness that supports the little consciousness that we are, consciousness with a capital C, we're consciousness with a small c. When you trace the source of your own consciousness in those quiet, still moments, after a while, you will start to contact higher levels of that master consciousness, and that's where you start to get information, you start to get insights, things start happening in your life, synchronicities start to happen, events, people who you haven't seen before start to appear in your life, and they all have a meaning, they're there for a purpose. So your life starts to take on a more perceptible, organized pattern. It's almost kind of miraculous the way these things happen when you sort of open up that spiritual valve through meditation.
A lot of people have a very hard time meditating because they won't allow their mind to be quiet.
I do too. Got to work at it.
Most people do. You got to work at it. Got to acknowledge it and pass it by. We're almost out of time, Peter, so could you give out the name of your book and your website and tell people how to get it one more time, please?
Yes, Pope Annalisa is the name of the book, part of the book one of the First Souls trilogy. The website is popeannalisa.com, P-O-P-E. A-N-N-A-L-I-S-A, one word, popeannalisa.com. And the book can be purchased at any major bookstore, or if you don't find it in the shelves, please go in and request that they can order it. Or you can buy it online through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
How important, again, Peter, just real quick, do you think it is that people open their minds and allow different concepts, let's call it, and different emotions come through?
Well, think of a camera lens. When the aperture of a camera lens is narrowed down, it doesn't let too much light in, and the picture is going to be dark. But the more you open up that aperture, the more light comes in, and the brighter the picture is, the more detail, the more clarity that you get in the picture. You can discern the fine details of what the picture is about. It's very similar in life, that the more we open ourselves up to these concepts and don't get stuck in a very narrow interpretation. And understand knowledge is provisional. The way I look at knowledge is I never feel I have the ultimate answer. Do I feel Pope Annalisa has the ultimate answers to life? Well, no, I don't, because life is a mystery. And the more I meditate on it, the more I study it, when I think I just have the truth, then it seems to be superseded by a higher view of the truth. So, you know, view your growth in life and accumulation of knowledge as a provisional thing. What you understand now, you may understand at a different level later on, but at least you are progressing. You're a long ways from where you started. And if we open that aperture of our lives and let more light in, we do see life in a different context. We see it with more clarity. We understand what reality is about. We learn a lot of things that we never would have suspected at different times of our lives, and that's all because we kept ourselves open to possibility. And that's what really life is about. Life is about possibilities, and the more you keep yourself open to the possibilities, the more choices you have in life.
Great. Great advice, Peter. Thank you very much for your insight and your knowledge, and I'm sure a lot of people will be picking up your book, if for no other reason, just because they're curious now as to what you had to talk about. So thank you for taking the time for being on the show.
Well, thanks. It's nice to be back on the show again. I enjoy speaking with you. Thank you.
You take care, Peter. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk next time. Take care. Bye now.